This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the December 12, 2018 edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. Before getting into today's program, I want to let you know that at 5:15 this afternoon, there will be a meeting of the KZYX Board of Directors at 564 South Dora Street in Ukiah. Those attending should use the side entrance off the driveway. Okay, now on with the show. On Friday night, Consortium News hosted an unusual video program, a three-hour online vigil for WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, hosted by Consortium News chief editor Joe Loria, and featuring, among others, former CIA analyst Ray McGovern, former New York Times correspondent Chris Edges, and famed whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg. The vigil was intended to call attention to the plight of Assange, who appears to be on the verge of being evicted from the Ecuadorian embassy in London and extradited to the U.S. to face charges of espionage. Assange's crimes? Exposing ugly and uncomfortable truths about U.S. foreign policy and military actions going back to the beginning of the Iraq War and extending to the release of the Democratic National Committee and John Podesta's emails in the run-up to the 2016 presidential election that revealed, among other things, the party's leadership's determination to sabotage the campaign of Bernie Sanders. At 20 minutes past the hour, I'll be speaking again with Consortium News' Joe Loria about the smear campaign that has been launched against Assange to tie him into Trump's Russiagate woes and undermine public support for the embattled publisher. So stay tuned for that. Regular listeners to Takes on the World are aware that I spend an inordinate amount of time speaking about the influence of the pro-Israel lobby on our U.S. political system and on the media. As I've explained before, I do that for a specific reason. It's simply because what I report to you about the lobby's activities, while fully reported in the Israeli press and the American Jewish press, is generally censored in the U.S. media, and that includes New York Times and other leading print media and on-air, all the TV networks, plus NPR and even Democracy Now! Take the case, for example, of Rand Paul, the junior senator from Kentucky. For more than 2 weeks, he has been holding up a vote by the full Senate on two bills, which, like every piece of legislation favoring Israel, enjoy wide bipartisan backing. The first is for an act which authorizes and would establish as U.S. law $38 billion in free weapons to Israel over the next 10 years that had been negotiated by President Obama with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Obama's last year in office, which represented the greatest gift by U.S. taxpayers to any foreign country in our history. The other bill expresses approval of the state and local measures that have already been passed that deny government contracts to businesses that boycott Israel and would add federal penalties to the charges. 24 states, including California, have already passed such legislation, but unless you heard it from me when Sacramento approved it and Governor Brown signed it, this is probably news to you. What Rand Paul is taking advantage of is a little-known rule that enables a single senator to hold up a vote on a piece of legislation if he or she doesn't like it. It isn't used very often, but in this case, the mainstream media has chosen to ignore what should be a big story, while pro-Israel lobbying groups, AIPAC and CUFI, that's Christians United for Israel, have launched all-out campaigns targeting Kentucky voters in an effort to pressure Paul to release his holds. So far, it hasn't worked. The editors of the Weekly Standard, the neocon House organ founded by William Kristol, criticized the senator's position, stating, Rand Paul and other opponents of the anti-boycott bill say they're worried it runs afoul of the First Amendment's guarantee of freedom of speech. But the right to free speech does not entail a right to government contracts, end quote. Legislation had drawn sharp criticism from the ACLU and other civil liberties groups last year, describing it as a threat to free speech. In response, the bill's author, Ben Cardin from Maryland, who serves as Israel's chief point man in the Senate, then modified it so businesses found in violation of legislation will only be fined and not have its CEOs sent to prison as the original legislation intended. One can imagine what South Africa would be like today if it had had a lobby even half as powerful as Israel's. Closer to home, in the closing minutes of the Ukiah City Council meeting last Wednesday, There was an echo of Donald Trump's prioritizing the usefulness of Saudi Arabia over downgrading relations with the oil-rich monarchy over Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's role in the murder and dismemberment of dissident Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. By a 4-1 vote, with former mayor and KZYX program host Steve Scalmanini being the lone dissenter, the Ukiah City Council rejected my objections as a resident of Ukiah to the city purchasing a backhoe and loader manufactured by the Caterpillar Company for use by city employees. Since 2005, Caterpillar has been the target of an international boycott and investment campaign in response to its ongoing sale to Israel, paid for by U.S. taxpayers, of its gigantic P-9 bulldozers, which have exclusively been used by the Israeli military to demolish Palestinian homes and greenhouses and rip up orchards of fruit and olive trees, many of them centuries old. In 2003, you may recall, one such bulldozer, driven by an Israeli soldier, while seeing her clearly, ran over and crushed to death 23-year-old Rachel Corey as she tried to prevent another home in Gaza from being reduced to rubble. That I posed their vote on the issue as a moral one as opposed to being a routine business decision was not appreciated by the Ukiah City Council majority as it began its new term. November 29th was the 71st anniversary of the United Nations General Assembly vote that called for partitioning Palestine into two states, with 55% and the coastline going to the Jews, who represented 30% of the population, and 45% to the Arabs, who rejected it. On the anniversary of that date, over many decades, the UN has been the site of a memorial conference, which was seen as a launching pad for one of the great crimes of the crime-filled 20th century, the ethnic cleansing of 750,000 Palestinians from their homeland. That the partition vote, which the Palestinians found unacceptable, came just 2 years after the revelations of another monstrous crime, Hitler's attempt to exterminate the Jews of Europe, is one of history's great ironies and explains why the conflict between Israeli Jews and Palestinian Arabs is still very much with us today. For the mainstream media, however, only the Israeli narrative is acceptable. This is what Temple University Mark Lamont Hill, who spoke at this year's Convocation for Palestine, learned the hard way when he was fired as a CNN commentator for comments made that were not acceptable to the Take No Prisoners censors of the Israel lobby. In his speech, Hill, an African-American, had the temerity to point out that the Palestinians, under harsh military occupation in the West Bank, and for all intents and purposes in Gaza for the past 51 years, have, under international law, every right to resist the occupation with armed struggle. While pointing out that fact, Hill didn't endorse it. Hill sealed his fate when, concluding his talk, he invoked a common Palestinian dream of a better future, saying, quote, "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free," end quote. Acknowledging the Palestinians' legal right to take up arms against the Israeli occupiers and calling for freedom for Palestinians is, for the Israel lobby's watchdogs, tantamount to calling for the genocide of the Jewish people, and 24 hours later, Hill, a paid CNN correspondent, was fired. That the accusations against Hill were unfounded is evident to anyone willing to watch his 21-minute, 7-second talk that can be found on YouTube. But there should be no question as to who is pulling the strings of the mainstream media. Though the chair of Temple University's board ripped into Hill yesterday, the university announced it will not punish Hill for his comments. The Foundation for Individual Rights in Education reports that after meeting with the school's board of trustees yesterday, Temple President Richard Englert released a statement noting Mark Lamont Hill, will neither be punished nor investigated for his comments. Englert said the professor, quote, spoke as a private citizen and his right to do so is protected by the Constitution, end quote. I have a hunch that will not be the end of it. In all the remembrances of the departed George H.W. Bush, there was one I was sure would be overlooked, except in the Israeli and American Jewish press, despite it being one of the main reasons, if not the main reason, he failed to win re-election in 1992. Bush Sr. was the last president to stand up to Israel, having gone on national television on September 12, 1991, at a moment when both houses of Congress were ready to override the veto of Israel's request for $10 billion in loan guarantees. 1,000 pro-Israel lobbyists were on Capitol Hill to make sure it would happen against, as Bush described it, one lonely guy. Bush told the American people why he was opposing getting the loan guarantees and how much aid each Israeli man, woman, and child was getting from the U.S. taxpayer. And that stopped AIPAC and Congress in its tracks. One Senator, Barbara Mikulski, a co-sponsor of the legislation, was meeting with 60 of the lobbyists when, as Larry Kohler wrote in the Washington Jewish Week, quote, "The meeting was interrupted when an aide to Mikulski handed her a note. Mikulski's face went ashen. She turned to the group and uttered the last thing they wanted to hear. 'I've just learned,' she said, 'the president has said he is taking his case for a 120-day delay to the American people,'" end quote. Imagine that, taking the issue to the American people. How dare he do such a thing? Well, the very next day, the head of AIPAC, Tom Dine, told the press, quote, "September 12, 1991 is a day that will live in infamy," end quote. But as Israel's Daily Haaretz recalled last week, Bush's public appeal for support worked. Polls at the time found that 86% of Americans agreed with the president's call for the loan guarantee delay. And major U.S. media backed his stance, with both the New York Times and Washington Post running editorials favoring his position, end quote. That was from Haaretz last week. What the article did not say was that 4 months later, Bush would again refuse to approve the guarantees because Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir would not agree to bar Russian Jews from settling in the West Bank and Gaza. By then, the Republican establishment and its pundits in the media had turned against Bush, blaming him for the country's economic downturn. Support for Israel had trumped their loyalty to their party and their president. In the end, after Shamir was forced to resign and was replaced by Yitzhak Rabin, Bush agreed to the loan guarantees with the caveat that any of the loan guaranteed loans spent settling Jews in the occupied territories would be deducted from the amount guaranteed. Bill Clinton, who would defeat him, soon reversed that restriction, permitting Israel to settle Russian Jews to settle anywhere it pleased without charging the loan guarantees. It's not inappropriate to mention that the first person Clinton hired to run his presidential campaign was a former staff member of AIPAC. Ireland, which had 6 centuries of experience battling British colonialism, has become the first country to push through a bill that will criminalize the import of goods from Israeli settlements and impose a 5-year jail sentence or a 283,000 euro fine on anyone found guilty of profiting from illegal settlement industries. The bill passed last Thursday will ban the import or sale of goods or services from settlements regarded as illegal under international law. The legislation, which passed in the Synod, a branch of the country's legislature, and approved without a vote, was met with sustained applause and a standing ovation by opposition senators. The bill makes an offense, quote, "for a person to import or attempt to import settlement goods," end quote, "or to assist anyone in doing so." The measure now needs the endorsement of the lower house of the parliament, known as the Dáil Éireann, before the Irish president can sign it into law. However, it's likely to face stiff resistance, according to the Irish Times, since the government is said to be reluctant to push the legislation further. This has been Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.